Hi, I'm Peggy Higgins. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, gosh. Well, first I want to thank Kathy and the committee for inviting me and the committee for putting this whole thing on. And you guys do such a nice job, and it always feels so warm and welcoming when I come here. This is just my second year. We came here last year mostly because of Oscar and Bev. You know, he got sober in Bishop and moved around and ended up in Ridgecrest, and we came down to visit a few times and got connected with you guys. So thank you, Oscar and Bev, for that. So, you know, that's the fellowship. It just expanded our whole AA world, and that's what we do. I want to welcome my peeps from Bishop that came. Yay. Yeah. We got a table full over here. So we're increasing our numbers year by year. And I want to welcome my friends from Ojai and Santa Paula. Such a surprise. I'm so glad you guys are here. And so my Ojai and Santa Paula friends, we made a mad dash over to Laughlin in January for their roundup. And guess who was there? And now they're stalking me here, you know. But I'm so glad they came. Okay, what I'm going to attempt to do is share some experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Am I too loud? Because I am loud up here. It's good? Okay. So as my husband says, I don't know what I'm going to share, but I'm going to share it anyway. And this is a God thing. I'm not a circuit speaker, so I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. I've only done one or two more than 10-minute shares, so I hope I can fill up whatever. How much time do I have?
About 2 hours.
Oh my God! A whole hour. Yeah, you guys are going to get so bored.
Best you can.
Best I can. Okay. So again, my name's Peggy Higgins, and I am an alcoholic. Currently live in Bishop. I got sober in Santa Paula and Ventura. My sobriety date is 9/1/88. You know, by the grace of God, you know, one day at a time, and I don't die. You know, if I don't die and I don't drink, I get one more day of sobriety. And that's all we all have, is one more day of sobriety. But I've learned a few things along the line, you know, on how to protect that and how to make that grow and how to deepen that understanding of the disease of alcoholism. And most of that is just keep showing up. Just keep showing up consistently and being willing to be willing. You know, that part in the big book, I got to be willing to be willing. If I can just open that door, just a little bit of willingness. So, for instance, saying yes to this craziness is, you know, a little bit of willingness. And I saw you ladies at the hotel. You're from Ojai too, aren't you? Welcome. Ojai. Woo! Ojai's in the room, yeah. No, I was behind you in the registration. Yeah, that's why I saw you. Sorry, got distracted. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous kind of in a roundabout way. I went to an OA meeting not knowing what that was. I went to Al-Anon not knowing what that was. And the thing that I saw in those rooms that got me to come back one more time to something was the light in your eyes and the smile on your face. And I noticed the peace in your hearts. And for me to even notice that, I don't know why I did, you know. But, you know, this is all a God thing, you know, right place at the right time. So to give you my state of mind when I went to my first 12-step meeting, I didn't take my checkbook and I did not take my credit card. Now, I knew nothing about 12-step programs. And I'm surprised I had a credit card, but I didn't take either one of them. Because if you would have said, this thing's going to cost you $1,200 tonight, I would have written you a check. I wouldn't have had money to back that up, but I would have written you a check because I didn't know how to say no. No was not in my vocabulary. So I had learned enough about myself, don't have any means of payment with you, and that way they can't get you. And I thought you were going to get me, you know, you were going to trap me. And I saw that basket go around the room at some point, and I'm watching eagle eye everything that's going on in that meeting because I'm thinking it's a scam. You know, you want something from me. Every relationship I had was transactional. Nothing was for fun and for free. And so when I saw the basket going around, I thought, okay, here it is. This is where they get you. And I don't know what I saw, whether it's a dollar or $5 or no dollars or a check be put in that basket. I don't know, but I just let that basket go by. And I thought, well, see, they're out to get you. They want something from you. This isn't everything it's cracked up to be. Not that I had a clue what it was, you know. But I wanted to come back, and I wanted to come back so bad that I heard a woman say, there's another meeting here Thursday night. And I went, okay, and I could not wait for Thursday night. I think it was Tuesday night. And I could not wait for Thursday night to go back to this meeting. And after that meeting, someone said, well, we go for coffee, you know, over here, and if you want to come. Scared to death, because now this is where you're going to get me. But I still show up. I show up for coffee after the meeting, and people got what they got, you know, their coffee, their pie, their whatever. And the first thing I noticed, because I'm so nervous and I'm so scared, and I'm thinking, you know, what are they going to want from me? You know, there's no trust involved here at all. And the first thing I noticed is that they were talking about these really normal things, like fixing the fence in their backyard, like meeting at the high school track to walk around the track. I mean, just like normal everyday stuff. And I didn't have those kinds of conversations with people. I didn't know people had those kinds of conversations. And that struck me. And it felt comfortable. And it felt at home, and it felt safe. But I'm still watching, you know, because somewhere you're still going to get me for something. And I see people, and I got to have my own car, right? I can't, like, go with anybody, because I got to be able to escape in case I don't know what. And I see people standing up, and I thought, oh, here, I got to leave first, because they're going to stick me with a bill. They're going to stick me with a tab, because I did that. I did that in bars, right? I would just get up and walk out. Someone will pay it. I don't know. And I thought, oh, well, they're going to get me, you know, for their coffee or their pie or their whatever. And the first guy stood up and I don't know, this was back when coffee was probably less than a dollar at Denny's, you know, and he threw a buck on the table and said goodbye. And everybody just kind of let him go out the door instead of, well, you can't go, you got to stay here. You know, that, you know, we're not done drinking, we got to party, we're partying, you know. That pressure to be something and somebody and don't leave. And nobody did that. He said, got to go, bye. And he threw his buck on the table. And someone else did that, and someone else did that. And I was just like shocked that there were people that behaved like this. And you know, what I perceived as normal behavior that I had lost touch with. You know, so to backtrack a little bit, I was raised in a pretty normal family. I don't come from a family of alcoholics. My brother and I are alcoholics, but my parents were not. And we were pretty normal. We didn't have a lot, but we always had food on the table. We always had clothes on our back. My parents did the best they could. They weren't bad people. There was a lack of connection in our house. We didn't talk. We didn't share feelings. You know, I don't know, German-Norwegian stuff goes on, you know. It's like that's kind of the background you come from, and you just take care of business, and you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and you don't whine about stuff. But it wasn't a mean thing. It was just, that's just how you behaved. And so how I interpret that in my young mind is I must have missed the lesson in something, because I don't know the answer to that. But you don't dare ask, because the expectation is you already have the answer, because no one's talking about it. And I didn't feel I had that kind of leeway or permission to ask something. Anything. I mean, anything. You know, how do you fix toast? I don't know. You know, anything. And so that all got twisted around in my head as I'm less than because I don't understand. And I cannot tell you that, because then you're going to know that I don't understand. You know, that's how that got interpreted through my life for many, many years. So, you know, I got a little personal background. I was I don't know, in ninth grade or something. I met a guy that was in high school, and he became my higher power instantly because I didn't have one. You know, I didn't have anything to connect to. My dad did the dad thing. My mom did the mom thing. But it's like nobody was home. You know, they were home, but it was like nobody was home. And he was more home. And he became the higher power. And I got pregnant before I got out of high school. And this was back when you didn't finish high school if you were pregnant, you know, or if you did, you had to hide it. And I was far enough along I couldn't hide it. So I don't know what month it was, March or something. I left high school. I got married. And I moved away, you know, because no one at high school can know this happened to me. You know, how embarrassing is this? This was back in the early 70s. And, you know, my parents just, I don't know, everybody assumed I'd marry this maniac. You know, I knew he was a maniac. I knew there was something wrong, but I didn't know how to say I can't. I don't know what to do here. I don't know what to do. And he was the higher power, and he was saying what we were going to do, and we're going to get married, and we're going to leave town. And that's what we did, you know, so that. And I wanted to, too. You know, I have to take ownership for that because I didn't want to be under, I didn't want to be in view of anybody that knew me because I was humiliated. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. So we moved to Ventura from Long Beach and proceeded to have a baby. And we were two children raising a child and didn't know what the hell to do and how to do it and didn't know how to be a wife and all of it. I got a job by hook or by crook. I got a job. This was not me. This was a God shot. I got a job with the County of Ventura. So it's one of those disgustingly secure jobs, you know, that once you're in there, it's kind of hard to get you fired from. And you just kind of keep moving along. And I, you know, no forethought in this at all. But I go show up to this job every day, and I put the little girl in childcare. And pretty soon I start to see that, there's other men. There's other boys. I didn't know there were other boys. And he's becoming less and less of a higher power, and I'm becoming more and more disgruntled. And I'm starting to see that maybe I can get out of this thing. And I got out of this thing, and it was an ugly, long, drawn-out divorce. So there I am now, single mom, working for the County of Ventura, disgustingly secure job. Thank you very much. You know, because, you know, that's why I'm retired today. You know, I came to appreciate that eventually. That's how life went for a long time. So when I got rid of him, because that's how it felt, he's finally behind me, then it was like, now I can start to live a life like I perceived you guys did. Now I can party. I can go have fun. You know, now I had all these resentments back here because a lot of the gals I went to high school with, they were like UCLA, USC, head cheerleaders, marry the football player. And I'm sitting on a couch with a baby and this man that I can't stand anymore, a boy that I can't stand anymore. So I had a lot of resentment and I felt like I had a lot of making up to do, And that's when my partying started and that's when my drinking started. And that's when I got out of control with the drinking. My feelings, you might not relate to any of my story, but I bet you can relate to my feelings somewhere along the line. My feelings growing up were the feelings, I believe, of an alcoholic. You know, I had the disease of alcoholism right from the get-go. My second birthday party was wrong. I knew it was wrong. There was something wrong with that party. And I carried that with me for years, the resentment that my parents didn't do it right. You know, so there was, that's just one little thing. You know, there was lots of those little feelings along the way. And I knew I'd lose my train of thought. I will get it back. Well, anyway, I'll catch up. So I'm divorced, I'm single, I'm raising this daughter. I began to party. Now I'm catching up because I'm just full of angst. You know, I'm full of, I got to do something. And all I knew to do was drink. And so I spent a lot of time in bars. I spent a lot of time out, you know, doing what we do. And, you know, when you're so naive and unworldly. That's kind of what I was. And I break out. I make lots of dumb decisions, lots of embarrassing, shameful things. And, you know, just a couple little stories along the way, in a bar drinking at night with a bunch of people I knew, and this gal hauls me into the bathroom, and I'm crying about something, I don't know what, and she says, "This is what happens when you drink too much." And I went, instantly defiant, you know, instantly, "I don't drink too much. What are you talking about?" You know. And another time, I woke up on this gal's couch the next morning, and I don't know what I said or what she said, but at some point she said, I said to her, "Oh, everybody does that when they drink." And she said, "No, they don't." And I was like, "Oh, man," and I was mad about that, you know, because don't tell me I'm not doing the right thing, you know. I can't take it because I don't know what the right thing is and how I'm supposed to get there. So I had a lot of those little incidences where people were trying to tell me that I was in trouble and I couldn't hear it because I was so caught up in my head. I had to get somewhere, do something, achieve something, and I didn't even know what that was. So this went on for quite a while. My ex-husband and I got in big, massive, you know, fights because, now he's an alcoholic too, by the way. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if he's an alcoholic. I really don't. He's never admitted that as far as I know. I, you know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, okay? So he's doing crazy things, I'm doing crazy things, and he's telling me about all the crazy things I'm doing, and all I can figure out to do is get away, get away, get away, get away. I didn't know how to confront, how to face a problem, how to deal with a problem. I didn't know how to look at anything. It was just, "Don't talk to me, don't talk to me, don't talk to me." That's how it was. And so time went on, I got more and more miserable, and I remember telling someone one time, "I feel like I'm boxing with the world. I feel like I have to like box with the world." And she's going, "I don't know what you mean by that." And, you know, it's like they're trying to get me, and I don't know what, you know, and I couldn't articulate that, and I couldn't say why, and, you know, the relief was in the drink. The relief was, let's go out one more time. And I kept this disgustingly secure job, thank God, you know, because, you know, God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, and God knew I needed to support this little girl, and I needed some stability, and that was all I had. So time goes on, I get worse, I get more miserable, I'm starting to get in trouble at work. I'm the chick that's doing cocaine behind the partition at work, and I'm the one that goes out at the half-hour lunch and doesn't show up for 2 hours. And I get called in, and my defiance was, "But everybody does that." You know, I still got that going on. Everybody does that. And my boss said, "No, they don't, and especially the women, and you're not doing it anymore." And it was like, he's picking on me. And so, you know, I had some bosses that really put up with a lot of crap from me for a long time because I was such an immature little girl in my mind, and I was troubled, and they were trying to help me succeed, and I appreciate that today. I really appreciate that today. So by hook or by crook, I get to this meeting, and then all that stuff happens with, you know, what do they want from me, and they distrust me, and all this stuff, and I'm not an alcoholic, by the way. I just have a problem stopping at the right time. I just need to stop at the right time. And I'm trying to figure that out. And I did everything our big book says. You know, I switched from wine to beer, and beer to wine, and wine to whiskey, and whiskey to vodka, and anything I didn't like so that I wouldn't drink as much. And it, you know what? It didn't work. I developed a taste for that thing that I didn't like. So I went to an Al-Anon meeting, I believe. Your Al-Anon people will, the Al-Anon people in the room will appreciate this, because so many of us get to AA through another 12-step program, I have found. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I thought I had this problem, that problem, and the other problem. And in the Al-Anon meeting, I started to hear stories of drinking. Not a lot, just, you know, I used to have a problem and I have a program, whatever I heard. And I guess, you know, my mind was in tune to that. And this was in Santa Paula. And those ladies, maybe somebody suggested, maybe they didn't, go to this AA meeting. And I did, and it was the best thing that I ever did. Now, I didn't come in there going, oh man, I'm an alcoholic, I'm in dire straits, I'm just so pitiful, I don't know what to do, I don't know how to quit drinking. No, I'm not telling you anything because you can't know that I don't know. I'm just thinking I will learn how to pace myself. I will learn how to not drink. I thought that's what it was. I didn't know what it was about. I had no clue what the 12 steps and 12 traditions were. And anytime anybody would read them, it was like black things floating on a white page. It just made no sense, nor did I care. I was looking for somewhere to be that was safer than where I was, whether that was in my head or in my own home, just safer, quieter, somewhere where I didn't have to struggle. I didn't know how not to struggle. So I was finding this in those meetings, and I'm hearing the story of alcoholism, and I'm beginning to go, yeah, maybe no, I don't think so. And I went to this big speaker meeting in Oxnard. Some of you may remember it. St. Anthony's Church had a big speaker meeting on Saturday night. I think maybe 7,500 people. People got there 2 hours early to set up, you know, the chairs and the coffee and all the that go on in a big meeting like that every Saturday night. Can you imagine the commitment? And so this gal asked me, that I went to OA with, by the way, she says, I do this thing on Saturday night, I go to this meeting, and it's a speaker. And then sometimes we go for coffee afterwards, or maybe dinner if we haven't had dinner or whatever. I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. I got nothing else going on. And I want more of what you have, and I don't even know what that is. You know, so much of my recovery is, I don't know what I want here, but I want more of. Well, I'm an alcoholic, of course I do. So I go to this meeting, and at some point, after a week or two or five, I don't know what, I see this woman who was the 10-minute speaker that night, and she worked in my building, and she worked on a floor that I never went to because it was kind of the mucky mucks. And she wore the kind of clothes I had to wear to work, you know, and this is back in the early 80s. You know, I'm talking business suits and pantyhose and pumps, for any of you that might know what that stuff is. there was a few years I could tell that story and people did, and now they don't. But anyway, there was a dress code. There used to be a dress code. And so I saw her and I thought, what the hell is she doing here? Oh my God. And but she's the first person I could relate to in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took what it took. And it took someone that was me, you know. And I could hear her. And what she talked about was, I don't remember any of her story other than her two martini nights. Before she could go anywhere, do anything, she had to have two martinis, and then whatever she said after that. And what I related to was anytime I was going to go somewhere at night, you know, to go party, to go out to a bar or someone's house or whatever, I would walk around the corner to the Save-On drugstore, and I would buy the cold drinks out of the box, two of them, club drinks, I think they were called. And I'd come back and I would have those two club drinks while I got ready to go out to drink. And so I related to her, you know, the power of identification. And I heard it. And I left that meeting with that gal that was in OA, who was also in AA, but I wasn't paying any attention to that. And I said to her, I think I might be an alcoholic. And she goes, yeah. And another incident happened. My brother was in a recovery home down in San Bernardino for a very long time because he's a very bad drunk. And not anymore, I'm kidding. This is how I viewed it. You know, he had to be there for a year because he's so bad. You know, he can't even come out and live in the real world. And I drove down there to pick him up, to visit with him, and we went to a little convention. I think it was in Long Beach. And we went to a few meetings, and he had to get back to his house, you know, by a certain time. And I'm driving him because he got no car. He's got nothing anymore. And we got out to the car, and I don't remember anything about that convention or roundup or whatever it is, other than we got back out to the car, and we were getting in the car, and I looked over the hood of the car, and I said, "Hey, Mike," and he said, "Yeah," and I said, "I think I'm an alcoholic." He goes, "Oh, of course you are." Yeah, you know, it's like, I don't even think he had words to say, because it was like, duh, you know, and I went, man, what's the deal? So that started my road of my entry into Alcoholics Anonymous, and still not connected with sponsor, not really connected with fellowship, because I didn't understand fellowship. Oh my friggin' God, you know, you want me to like be with people that, you know, are going to find out about me. That's kind of how, you know, I didn't consciously think that, but that's really what that was. And I didn't understand anything that was being read in the room. I was just there because it was comfortable while I was there. It was comfortable. And so I didn't take a drink for 9 months, and I showed up to meetings, and I went out to dinner with the girls, and I, you know, did whatever was happening, and I'm an alcoholic, half-heartedly. And 9 months go by, and here's the ticket. 9 months, no action. No action. And I don't know what was going on in my life at work or at home, but the thought came to me, I'm going to go have a drink. I can have a drink. I haven't drank for 9 months. There's no problem here. However I played that out in my mind, I don't know. Called this gal that was my drinking buddy. All her and I ever did together was sit at her kitchen table and drink beer. That's all we ever did. I knew I could count on her for that. And I called her and I said, "Do you want to go out somewhere and have a drink?" "You? I thought you didn't drink anymore." "No, I can drink. I haven't had a drink for 9 months. I don't have a problem with that." "Okay." So we got our little selves dressed up and we hopped on down to this. I picked her up and we went to this really nice bar restaurant in Ventura and sat down, and I'm smarter though, so I ordered wine spritzers because they don't have as much alcohol in them. That I can go farther. And I don't know if I had one or two, but all of a sudden, there was shots of tequila on the table. Now, I didn't order them, but somebody ordered them. There were some gentlemen that we knew in this bar, and we started partying with them, and I looked at those shots of tequila, and I thought, oh, shit. Oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit. And I call it God, call it whatever. I stood up and I said, "I gotta go." And I turned around and I walked out. And I never did have a shot of tequila. I probably had maybe two wine spritzers at the most. I left her there. She drove with me in my car. Anyway, I just knew I had to get out of there. Like, all I could see was a beeline out to get out now. And I did, and I didn't drink again. And because of my ego and my self-centeredness and my selfishness, I couldn't admit to all of that for a very long time. I don't know, very long time, a couple months maybe. And time gets fuzzy after you've been sober for, like, a few years. You go, what was that back there? You know, how many months was that? I'm not real sure, but it happened. And so I go back to meetings, and I finally admit the truth. And, you know, I recognize that I'm a real alcoholic. And that's where the recovery began. And that's when I started to take the action. And the action was I got a sponsor. And I tried a couple on for size because I don't really trust you and I don't really believe you and I don't know what you're doing. And and I don't think, you know, this is going to work for me. I don't know what I was thinking. I was just thinking I'm different, I'm unique, you know. Not those words, but that's really what that is. You know, I'm special. You know, the curse of specialness. And, you know, I hook up with this gal, and I work the 12 steps to the best of my ability. You know, certainly not the first time, won't be the last time, and it wasn't the best time, but it was the best that I could do then. And just a little story about the fourth step. I went over to her house, and this was like a Sunday morning, and she always read the LA Times and was drinking coffee. She said, yeah, come over, and she says, we'll have coffee, and I'll listen to your, I'll do your fifth step with me. And so I went over there, and we sat on her bed, and she was up against her headboard with her pillows, and she had the LA Times, and she says, okay, start reading. Here comes the paper. And so people get, like, offended when I tell this story because they go, how rude of her, you know? I don't know. I read my fifth step. I didn't have a problem with it. She wasn't looking at me, and that was okay with me. And she just, keep going, keep going. And that was the first layers coming off, you know, the first layers coming off. And, you know, I was hooked and I was sold that this program had something to offer that I needed. And I certainly didn't have a clue yet what it was. I just knew that I, as I said before, I felt safe. I felt wanted. I felt like there was something here for me to grow from. And today, my feelings about that are, and let's see what that is. You know, what's next? I don't know. You know, what's next? There was a period of time where I really thought that I understood it all, and I don't really need to go to meetings that often. You know, I don't need to go to that many meetings, and I don't really like some of those people anyway, and I get really tired of hearing the readings, And I think there's a lot of us that can relate to that, you know, because it's like one more time. And now I feel like, yeah, one more time. I get to do that. I get to do that today. Doesn't mean I'm always happy when I'm in meetings. Doesn't mean I always want to hear everything. I don't want to hear her share again or him share again, the same old thing, you know. They probably think that of me. I don't take it personal anymore. I don't take them personal. I don't take me personal. It's sort of like, that's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. And so when I was about, I don't know how sober was I, Pat? 3 years sober? 3 years sober. I used to go to the speaker meeting on Friday night in Ventura. And there was this group of guys that sat up at the front of the room. Now I'm single. I'm legitimately single, and I would like a relationship. And there's a group of guys that sat up at the front. And forgive me, but I called them the women haters because that's what it appears to me that they all were. And my future husband was sitting at the end of one of those rows with these guys, not attached to them whatsoever. He just happened to be sitting there. And he turned around just to look down the aisle, and I saw him. And I thought, oh, shit, he's one of those women haters. And that was all I thought, you know. Anyway, time went by, and we ran into each other. I'll get the story wrong, so I'm not going to tell you all the details, but we ran into each other a couple of times. We talked a couple of times, and then he finally asked me out. And I realized he was not one of those guys, you know. I don't even know if those guys were one of those guys. That was just me, you know, making shit up. MSU, right? How many times do we do that? And so we went out, and it was love ever after. It was Mr. Wonderful. No. Well, yes. Well, yes, it was. I'll tell you, it was the best relationship I've ever had, you know? It was a healthy relationship. It was a relationship based in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a relationship based in God first, program second, us third. Now, I don't know that we always knew that, and we didn't convey that. You know, we're not those couples that just sit and talk about all that stuff and define everything. We just haven't been that way. It just was sort of like a known entity. So one of the first things I appreciated about Pat, my husband, he spoke up here before. He's got the story with Oscar and the jail and all that. You guys remember him. And Oscar was never coming to my house until he was. And what was I going to say? Where was I? Before. Met Pat. Oh, yeah. Okay, so one of the first things that I recognized about myself and about him is that if anything about program came up, a 12-step call, a phone call, a retreat, a meeting, a whatever, you go, I go. And we've always played those cards that way. It's like, that's more important than whatever. And it's always worked out really well. So I don't monitor his program, he doesn't monitor mine. It gets a little dicey sometimes living in the same house, you know, with two recovering alcoholics and going to the same meetings all the time. So, you know, when I lived in Santa Paula and I lived in Ventura, I didn't have to go to meetings with him. I didn't have to. Now, you know, we're in Bishop. There's not that many meetings. So that was kind of new territory for us to explore once we got to Bishop. Oh, shit, he goes to every meeting I go to, you know. So you just get used to that. You know, we've overcome that, you know, I guess. So, you know, I've got a good marriage today. I've been married for 32 years. Can you imagine an Alcoholics Anonymous being married to the same person? It's not him and it's not me. Trust me. It's God. It's got to be God all the way. And it's got to be Alcoholics Anonymous. Where else am I going to get that course for living? Where else am I going to get those directions to follow? I didn't get them anywhere else. I tried churches, I tried self-help books, I tried gurus, I tried all of that. Tell me what to do. I couldn't apply one thing that they even told me. I just couldn't apply it. Why is it when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous I could start to apply it? I don't know. Why? Why could I apply it there? Why could I take action there and not somewhere else? So in retrospect, what that tells me is that I'm an alcoholic and I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous and I needed that. I needed that. And I'm so grateful today that I found that. So fast forward, we decided in 2014 that we wanted to take a little adventure. Now this is a leap of faith because, you know, not many people in their right minds do this. We sold the house, we sold all our stuff, and we jumped in a motorhome and said, let's go. And we had no idea where we were going to end up and how long we were going to be on the road. And again, it was that dependence on God and Alcoholics Anonymous. Because wherever we went, we found a meeting. Not every time, but often. This was before the chair app, you know, the meeting app. It was before the good online information, and we really struggled in some towns to find the damn meeting. You know, we go to this church, no, it hasn't been here for 2 years, and go to that back of restaurant. Pat went to a back of a restaurant, and there was supposed to be a men's meeting there. No, there's no men's meeting. It's like, oh my God. And you know, I look back on that, it was some of the best times, and the deal was is we put the effort in. We always put the effort in. So one night, I found an Al-Anon meeting close by where we were camping, and I said, I'm going to an Al-Anon meeting, you know, please. And I get to this big church campus, and it's dark, and there's not one sign anywhere. Nothing. I travel the halls of this church, you know, it was one of those that had the big classrooms and all that. Finally, down at the end of this hall, the door was open, the light was on, and here's an Al-Anon meeting. I'm 15 minutes late because I'm traveling this whole campus. So I was pissed at them, you know. I said, you know, it wouldn't hurt to have a sign out there. Welcome. And they started talking about the plans they had, about the barbecue coming up, about the whatever meetings, service meetings they were having. I thought, I want to live here. They have a good group, you know. And that's kind of how that ended up in almost every town we were in when we found a good meeting. It's like, well, let's live here. You know, they got good AA here. We walked into one meeting one night and wasn't sure what we were walking into. And it happened to be a potluck. It was like a Saturday night. They had a potluck. Then they had the meeting. And I don't know who started it because my husband's kind of a joker, but we walked in and they immediately started giving him shit. And he says, finally, I found my people. And we laughed and we had the best time with those people. And that's what we found in everywhere that we've traveled. And that's what convinced me that AA is everywhere, you know. But I have to be willing to go look for it. You know, you're not going to come and knock on my door, you know, and pull me out of my house and say, you know, let's go to this meeting. It's my job, you know, it's my job to stay in action here. And I try to do that today to the best of my ability. Well, we had some, time goes by and we've been here, there, and everywhere, and bad weather, good weather, nothing east of the Rockies because I didn't want to live east of the Rockies, but we had some doctor's appointments in Ventura and Santa Barbara, and it was about a month out, and we were coming out of Arizona, and we said, well, we'll stay in Indio for a while, and I didn't like it there. And, well, let's go to Death Valley. It's perfect time of year, February, you know. Went to Death Valley, stayed there for a few days, and then still had time to kill. You know, we got to, like, dawdle here, you know, for a while until we need to go to, because there's nowhere to stay in Ventura and Santa Barbara, you know, in your big motorhome. So Pat says, well, let's go to Bishop because we've been there for how many, you know, vacations for years. Let's go to Bishop and we'll hang out there. So we went to Bishop, got a campsite, stayed there, and we started, and we were at a campsite, campground that happens to be right behind town, sort of. So lots of walkability, and we walked every day with the dog. And kind of went, that's kind of nice here. You know, well, we'd already been there many times and gone to meetings there, and we met people. We probably met Mike and Marilyn and, you know, Diane and lots of people in Bishop, and they got good meetings here. They have good meetings. And so we went to more meetings. I found the women's meeting, went to the women's meeting, went to lunch with the girls. He did the same with the guys. Well, not so bad, not so bad. So we kind of went, well, let's call a realtor. Well, you know, the rest is history, you know. The long and short of it is we found a house, and then we had to hit the road again because we have these doctor's appointments. And then we also had plans to travel up north to Washington, and, you know, we go, well, we'll be back down. I guess, you know, if escrow happens while we're on the road, I guess it'll happen. That was a God thing because who does that? Who goes on the road and travels when you're in escrow, you know? And you know what? It just all worked out. By the time we hit Bridgeport, they said, okay, you got to do X, Y, and Z. Drove down to the Mammoth Business Center. They took care of everything for us. I drove back to Bridgeport, finished our time there. Called the realtor and said, okay, well, like, we're ready to come, but I know escrow doesn't close. I don't think it closed for like 3, 4, 5 days or something. He says, oh, you can go over there. I got the keys. It's like, who does that? You know, they don't let you in a house before you own it. And they let us in the house. And, you know, so we were there with our motorhome and no furniture, nothing. And we started over again. And, you know, so far it's been a good decision. You know, so far. Of course, you know, I was telling Vicki, my friend from Santa Paula, there is no shopping in Bishop. You know, if we want any shopping, we come down to Bridgeport or down to Ridgecrest or we go up to Reno. But, you know, I haven't missed out on anything. You know, I used to think I'd miss out on a Target or I'd miss out on a Walmart or I'd miss out on being able to stop here or stop there for this or that or the other thing. We've got everything we need there. You know, we get all our needs met. And, you know, it's been a good place to land. It's been a good place to land. Maybe it'll be for the rest of our time. I don't know. Maybe it won't. But as long as we've got AA under our belt and keep it there and remember this is a program of action and not let my brain take me somewhere else, but I have a lot of people around me that keep me secure in that. And I hear the message all the time. And I live in a 12-step home with my husband. And that's not always the case, but it's, you know, it works for us. And I don't know what else to say about that. You know, I've got a good life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that. I have a God in my life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that, I never had that before. I was it. You know, I was it. You know, I have a program for living through those 12 steps and those 12 traditions. And I have ample opportunity for service work. I have ample opportunity for fellowship. I don't ever have to sit back and say nothing's going on here. If nothing's going on here, it's nothing's going on here. You know, and it's very easy for me, or maybe other, maybe you can relate, to point the finger and say, God, I wish this was different. I wish that was different. This isn't enough for me. That's too much for me. And, you know, what I've come to understand is that it's my perspective. And I have an opportunity every day to change my attitude and change my perspective. And I wouldn't know how to do that. How do you do that? I didn't know how to do that. I didn't come in here equipped with tools to, like, change, you know. And I get to change, and I hear a lot of people talk about, you know, they hate change, they don't want things to change. I kind of enjoy it. I kind of enjoy change. I like things changed up a little bit, you know. But what never changes is the principles of this program. And the only thing that changes, really, is what comes out of here. So I get to, like, bounce off that wall back there and go, is that the steps? Is that traditions? Is that the principles? Am I following that? Are we doing a good job with that in our meeting? You know, do we need more service workers? What do we need here? You know, what needs to be updated, changed, and looked at? And I'm just so glad to be a part of that, you know, because I can be a part of that. And I don't feel like I'm this outlier, you know, that doesn't belong anymore, that doesn't understand, that doesn't know. And that thing of, I don't know, it's okay today. I don't know hardly anything. You know, I know what I know today, and that changes on a daily basis. And to be able to just be there and be open with that, that's such a freeing experience. So all of these gifts that I'm talking about, they're all, for me, they are all a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, I want to thank you very much for inviting me to speak, and I hope you heard something you can use. And if you didn't, thank you very much for listening to me. You did a good job for me.